Hello, kids. Matt Segundo here. There was once a time in my life in which I actually considered being Russian, which I understand is possible despite the limitations of one's birth certificate. Anyway, I never could get the hang of that crazy Cyrillic alphabet, and I've always preferred tequila to vodka, until those crazy damn Russians find a way to get a worm inside one of those bottles of Stolichnaya. I'm a true blue American, damn it, who you'll find chasing underage girls on the sands of Miami Beach. Assuming, of course, that the Greyhound will get me there and someone will pay my fare. Perhaps Gary Steingart knows more about one's weight in gold than me.
Okay, so I am here with Gary Steingart, who is the author of the Russian Debutante's Handbook and most recently Absurdistan. Gary, how are you doing?
Great, thank you. Great to be here.
That's great to have you here. I wanted to first of all ask an obvious question. How did Misha Weinberg come about? I mean, he bears certain kinds of similarities to Prince Mishkin from The Idiot. And I wanted to actually ask you about that because his attention to Rowena's emails reminded me very much of Mishkin's obsession with Natasha. So maybe you can talk about how this character came about and was Dostoevsky sort of a muse here?
Dostoevsky's always a muse, but I think I've always been addicted to fat man fiction. You know, I've always been the fatter the better. So,
Nero Wolfe fan?
Well, starting out basically with Rabelais, with Gargantua.
Yeah.
Then moving down to, well, Mishkin. I don't remember Mishkin if he was that fat. I'm thinking more of Oblomov, the Russian, by Goncharov, who is a nice big fatty and who never gets off the couch. Except at some crucial moments. And I also work in bed. I don't really move very much. I don't know. My metabolism has been great so far, so I'm not so big. But when I was 13 or so, I was actually a very husky child. I had to have a special suit made for my bar mitzvah, a special husky suit. So there's a big fat guy inside this little frame, just dying to get out. And the other thing is, I guess, was the American novel, Confederacy of Dunces. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking primarily of Ignatius O'Reilly, I was asked recently to pick my favorite book in America in the last 33 decades, and that was the book that came to mind. A wonderful, rambling, historical, a place also very rooted in its locality, New Orleans, and about a guy who loves to consume everything in sight, those lucky hot dogs I'm thinking of, you know. So I love to eat myself, and I love anything that having to do with food. So I wanted to make my guy gigantic. And I wanted to make him a real consumer, you know, in a very American mold, but also in a kind of nouveau riche Russian mold. So everything he consumes, girlfriends and political ideas, and then, of course, those yummy, yummy sturgeon kebabs that he can't get enough of, dipped in plum sauce.
Well, I must point out that the sexual episodes are alarmingly realistic in the sense that you refer to Misha's man boobs and the like. So I must ask you, who is clearly not 325 pounds,
right.
What steps you took to sort of get inside this fat man?
Well,
inside little friend?
Some of my fatter friends, I would feel them up a little bit, and then I would go
feel
to...
Feel them up literally?
Yeah, feel them up a little bit. And just I would go to Russian banyas, you know, Russian baths, and just see how a fat man, somebody in that category, the over 300 pound, how they move around, how... When they sit down, where things ripple, where things fall into place, you know, and it's just been quite an education. I learned to think fat, be fat, eat fat, and make love fat.
Gotcha. Now, going back to this whole obsession with fat man lit, which fat lit, I suppose, will have a new sort of category here. Was it just the overweight attribute that you drew upon? Are you sort of drawn to misfits? Do you feel that misfits are best characters for satirical texts like this?
I do in some way, but also it's I want to be fatter. You know, I mean, I'm a very small man, and I've always felt myself very unnoticeable in many ways. Mm-hmm. I really blend in wherever I go, which often can be good in terms of journalistic activities. You sort of just blend into the woodwork, but I've always wanted to be somebody big and powerful in the sense of just being able to walk into a room and everyone's eyes can't help but fall on you. In terms of Misha's lovemaking proclivities, I would say that Biggie Smalls, the rapper, Notorious B.I.G., was a big part of that. You know, that man, everyone was in love with that man, and he was a beautiful, brilliant tub of a man. And Misha, of course, also tries to rap in Absurdistan, but he does it with disastrous, I think, circumstances. Yeah. He was a big inspiration.
Well, there's a good deal of hip-hop that is embedded within his vernacular, and I'm wondering... Did you sort of do any research, or was this more of an instinctive choice for him to gravitate upon hip-hop as a way to kind of deliberately mishear certain aspects of things?
No, this is definitely an instinctive choice. I mean, I went to a college filled primarily with pasty white men who would hip and hop at every opportunity. And also it was very interesting for me to travel around the world, and I mean, I think almost every country in the world has its own hip-hop, I wouldn't say tradition, but its own attempt at hip-hop, let's just say. Yeah. And some of the times, especially in countries where there's a kind of ethnically charged atmosphere, the lyrics can be pretty awful in terms of, let's get these people and do their sisters, etc. You know, so there was I think, some real... there was some inspiration from actual hip-hop that I would hear when traveling abroad.
Going back to what you were sort of saying about this disparity between being a little man and being sort of unnoticed versus being a larger man and being noticed, I want to ask you two questions. One, are you the kind of guy who always gets asked for directions?
Yes. Actually, that is so true.
Yeah.
That is very interesting. I'm Mr. Reliable, you know. Yeah, that's funny that you would point that out.
Yeah, because I have the same sort of situation myself.
Hey, Mr. Non-Threatening Man.
Yeah, exactly.
How do I get to the Moscow?
If only they knew, huh?
If only they knew what rages inside this heart.
Well, I'm wondering if such a disparity is kind of a way for you to latch on to, I guess, these sort of misperceived literalisms that are in your work that are, we were discussing about the hip-hop, for example.
Oh, sure. No, I think once you have a character who's larger than life, everything else becomes larger than life around him. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great vehicle. It's very hard to sustain it over a certain amount of pages. There's only so many times you can talk about man boobs, a woman burying her face in some man boobs. That gets old after a while.
Yeah.
So, you can only do it for so long. But
there is a lot of sex in this.
There is a lot of sex. Well, there's a lot of sex in everything I write. Yeah. I mean, I think, my heroes, they may be deluded, but they're vital. They want life. They've been repressed for too long. They've been oppressed for too long. So they crave food. They crave sex. They crave love. They crave respect. They crave all the different things that have been denied to them.
Do you feel that having a character who had such an appetite was the best way to approach some of these political and social constructs that you were examining?
I mean, I see Halliburton as a kind of equivalent of a giant fat man striding across the earth and, things collapsing beneath its footsteps. So yeah, Misha and the environment, kind of failing, gigantic failing things. The Soviet Union was one of them, Misha is one of them, and America in some ways is becoming one of them too.
Yeah.
So that was the idea, I think. But also insatiable appetites. We live in a civilization, a society where debt is consuming everything in its path, and people just don't know when to stop. They don't understand why they want the amount of things, the number of goods and services that they want, but they want them. And Misha is the consummate consumer, and that in a sense makes him the consummate American. And that's why he wants that Golden Eagle passport.
There's also, there's that, and there's also the technological considerations in this book. You have a lot of email, you have a lot of very sort of specific, aspects of technology. For example, Ruslan the Enforcer, and the whole domain squatting scenario that he faces. And it seemed to me very interesting because you don't see a lot of satires that have such explicit technological references. Maybe you can elaborate on this.
Well, we have to think, literature in some way has been really blindsided by the internet. I mean, we live in a society where people feel much more comfortable dealing with little bursts of information on the screen than they do with actually processing an entire book, which requires almost shutting down all the systems that we always have up, the email and the beeper and the iPod and this and that. But on the other hand, you can't ignore that this is how people live, and this is exactly how people live. This novel is set in 2001. There's been even a gigantic sea change between then and now.
Yeah.
I am writing now a novel set in the immediate future, a very close future, and it is almost completely mitigated through different electronic means.
It is an apocalyptic novel.
Sure, very apocalyptic.
Really, really, yeah. It's the Vogue right now.
That is the Vogue, yeah. But mine isn't as, it's not like the Road or something. It's not going to be, America's not going to be wiped out, but it will become illiterate.
Okay. But going back to this idea of technology, and why do you think a lot of people sort of, I guess, are in denial about it? Are writers, I suppose, just generally kind of fearful of technology? Or, I mean, it's very much as much of a construct as politics or social.
There's something boring about technology, for me anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something... Of course, I can't comment. I mean, this is going to be a gigantic generational shift between what's coming up now and where we were. So I just don't understand. To me, everything is about connection and about real human contact. And I don't understand why these things need to be electronically mediated. I mean, I write email and I answer email and things like that. But I think a cyber reality for me is not quite as interesting as what I actually see walking down the street.
Sure.
You know, so I'm still of that old school where it's all about the actual physical connection. And Misha's certainly about the physical connection.
Yeah.
So there are interesting ways to write about it, of course. And I'm hoping I'm doing it in Surstan and in the next book. But I think in some ways I end up making fun, too, of the way emails are written, certainly of the lack of grammar and any kind of... Their stream of consciousness, but these stream of consciousness, because they're on the screen, reveal just how little people know and how little they understand about the world around them. They become a kind of record of our stupidity and our ignorance.
Well, also, Misha sort of relies upon these emails in various locales of the world. So there's this kind of clutching on to everything. His appetite even clutches on to technology.
Sure. Well, he has no choice, really. I mean, he has to communicate somehow.
Yeah.
And one thing, of course, that you'll notice is the poorest part of the earth will have an internet cafe at this point. It is how we live.
I wanted to actually ask you, the reception of this book has been really tremendous. People have compared you to Joseph Heller.
Wow.
in at least three reviews I read. And I'm wondering if this is a sort of representation of just how little satire there is out there in contemporary fiction. What do you think of this? You know, I mean, and you've also recently got the best young American novelists accolade, too.
Well, there are satirists. I mean, even in that list, the Granta list of best young writers.
There should be a best satirist.
Should be a best satirist list. There's several. Gabe Hudson is a wonderful satirist. Wrote Dear Mr. President. Others don't exactly write satire, but have a highly comedic tone to their writing. Nikhil Sharma, for example. So, I think, you know, satire flourishes when evil and stupidity collide. That's the best time for satire, and we are living in. This is so easy, you know, in some ways it's too easy. The incompetence of our government and of our system is just so clear that it's anybody could see it. And in a sense, when you embark on a satire, your duty is in some ways to point out the things that others have missed or to try to find a backdoor. For example, Absurdistan in many ways is a book about America, despite being a book about other things. And it's a way of getting to America by looking at Americans abroad and seeing how American corporations behave abroad and how American State Department behaves abroad and kind of putting together a picture of America based on those things.
But at the same time, people are actually latching onto this book as, oh, this could be the next Joseph Heller. We got to stick it. We got to, you know, put our chips in this guy, so to speak. And I'm wondering if this speaks to the paucity of satire that is now.
You mean that there's no other?
Either that or as you sort of have Misha suggest with the Jerry Steinfarb character, like, you know, the Americans lapped it all up with the hand job bastardization of your first novel.
I don't know. I think there are other. Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections had a satiric edge to it to some extent.
It wasn't like an explicit satire the way you are, though.
Well, maybe then the success of the book partly rests on the fact that there is such a paucity of it. I mean, that I am the only person that's doing it to some extent. So maybe if a few more competitors came on the scene, I'd have to, you know, turn in my chips and...
do a pay-per-view or something.
Do pay-per-view, right, exactly.
Well, actually, I wanted to talk about the Jerry Steinfarb self-mockery thing. How did that come about? I mean, and why did you want to? It's almost just sort of begs the question: why did you want to present yourself as this womanizing professor, or some character like you?
I just wanted to have some fun with that, you know. And I hate taking myself seriously. After the first book came out, there were all these interview requests. People wanted to know what I thought of the burqa or this or that, you know. And I thought, what the hell? I didn't want to become this kind of obnoxious know-it-all. So Steinfarb is sort of just a reminder to myself to keep myself in check and to just talk about things that I know.
It's almost a sort of postmodern kind of character you present by presenting yourself into this. Was this just a way to kind of keep things going? Do you find, for example, plot? Because this book is very vignette-oriented. Did you find plot to be something of a burden?
I don't think so at all. I think this book is pretty plot-driven. I mean, there are vignettes, but...
Yeah.
When I write a book, I'm pretty old-fashioned. You know, for example, there were 37 plot points that went into Absurdistan, which I actually sketched out before the book began. Some of them I had to be discarded. Others were added, but I had a pretty good idea of the different actions that would have to happen. In this case, I almost feel myself as a kind of 19th-century writer, you know, with a kind of very... I don't think of it... I mean, there's maybe some postmodern touches, but I think this is actually pretty old-school stuff.
Do you need a plot in place so that you can then have like a character like Misha riff upon various sorts of things that he experienced?
No, first comes the character, always. First comes the character, then come the plot elements, and then the character and the plot elements duke it out for whatever needs to happen. That's how it's been with the first two books. But the new book is written in a very epistolary format, so it's a lot of emails and messages and stuff like that, and it's between basically two characters. It's a kind of love story, and I'm letting them pretty much write this thing themselves. You know, gotcha. Their interactions will determine what happens next.
Well, in terms of the sort of mishearing that I was sort of talking about, the kind of misattribution, for example, Golly Burton standing in for Halliburton and Snack Daddy instead of Mac Daddy. How did these things come about? Were these things sort of an innate aspect of the character? How did this vernacular sort of, how was it devised?
I'm just pricking up my ear and hearing how people talk. You know, hookers in the Russian part of the world may say Golly Burton because the H is often substituted by the G.
Of course, there's that.
So Golly Burton, Snack Daddy. I think there actually was a Snack Daddy at some point in my life. I think in college there was a fat guy named Snack Daddy. So the key is just always, you know, a writer's like a doctor. You're always on call. I came away with about 300 pages of notes before I even began Absurdistan. And so stuff like that I think is very important. I do, you know, people talk about the novel being besieged by nonfiction. I think good writers in the past didn't just focus on their parents' divorce in Westchester. You know, they went out into the world and they saw what was going on and they understood what was going on and they learned more about, not just about themselves, but their country, where they came from. Everything sort of fit into place once you do a kind of exploration of the world, and I certainly did that with Absurdistan.
So for you, basically, you filled up this notebook filled with observations before you kind of plunged into it. Sure. And you have to do that for each of these books?
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. I lived in Prague for a while, took a lot of notes there for the first book, which is partly set in a Prague-like city. Yeah, I'm a big fan of notes. I'm very bad at keeping them. They're always on these little pieces of paper, but...
Well, I'm wondering, though, at what point do you sort of deviate from these notes and kind of, you know, dwell upon, I guess, your own imagination, or are you rooted almost exclusively in realism for your humor?
It differs. I mean, you know, Absurdistan is more of a journalistic work than people think. Yeah. People are always shocked by thinking, oh, you really exaggerated things, but it's anything but, you know.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't think of it, but I think it's always a mixture, you know, of the personal, what I observe, and then going one extra mile. You know, in terms of letting the imagination really pick things up and put them into place, but in a way that doesn't feel like it's untrue. You know, everything that in Absurdistan either did happen or could have happened. You know, nothing is outlandish in what I write. Because the world we live in is one at this point that's completely unfettered. Anything can happen. The old ideas of any kind of governments, let's say, taking care of their citizens and wishing them well, that's all gone out the window at this point. You have a series of rapacious elites around the world that want to screw everyone in sight, enrich themselves, you know, that old saying, it's not enough to succeed, others must fail, you know. And when I started writing the book, my idea was that, I always thought that, you know, Russia would become more and more like America. But in the end, America became more and more like Russia. And I think the book, some ways, in the character of Misha, in this gigantic guy, the two nations, the two ideals collide. And not only collide, but in the end make friends. There's a kind of realization for Misha that the corruption that he inherited from his father, it can do him well in New York or London or anywhere else, you know. It's transferable. So there's a huge lack of morality throughout the book.
Gotcha. Is there a certain kind of, I guess, series of degrees of exaggeration in terms of what you take from your notes? I mean, is there a certain kind of, do you place certain caps upon how far you can go in order to actually keep these details real?
No, it's a very organic process. I don't meditate on things. Let's say I have a note about something, I'll riff on that note till it feels right. Mm-hmm. If by the end what was in the note is completely gone, then that's that. You know, you have to use, it's like kindling for the fire, and then the fire takes off on its own and hopefully burns on its own.
I guess at what point, though, is the sort of, you know, does the fire actually start from the kindling? What do you do to sort of, I guess, is it just from transposing from a note into a sort of fictive template?
Or? It could be as simple as sitting at a cafe and noticing how people in a certain elite will talk to the waiters around them. And that can become a scene where a person talks to a servant in a mansion. It doesn't have to be exactly the same thing. It's just grasping for straws, grasping for ideas, and then making sure that there is a kind of veracity, but at the same time that it's enjoyable for the reader. I'm still in the old school of writers that believe that fiction can be entertaining. It doesn't, you know, if it's enlightening, if it's illuminating, that's wonderful. But I certainly think that it has to have an entertaining component, because that's the kind of fiction that I love.
I wanted to actually, again, go back to Misha's vernacular, which we kind of briefly touched upon, and that is it's this sort of interesting combination of 10-cent words as well as these deliberate sort of malapropisms. So, again, we're establishing here that these kind of came from your own observations, but, I mean, in terms of translating this into the character, did you know it? At what point was he speaking sort of fairly innate to you?
Well, I think he was always in my mind because I think partly of the kind of education that I got, you know, at Oberlin College, where people would switch, you know, what is it, high and low German, you know, they would switch between these very hilarious academic terms and then would go into personification of almost ghetto characters, you know. There was this sense of slumming linguistically while at the same time using highfalutin words and using academic tropes.
Yeah.
You know, it was the kind of place where there were classes with names like Prince's Royal Badness, you know, so there really was no divide. And in Misha's mind, there is no divide either. You know, he is a multicultural studies major. And so there's also a lack of rigor in Misha's thinking. He never follows anything through. He sometimes has bits of insight, but in the end, he's wrong about everything. Which makes him lovable and tragic in my view. There is a lack of connection between the various things that he sees. And a lot of people fail to make these connections. So to me, that makes Misha more of an everyman, except a large everyman with millions of dollars to his name.
Well, what of, like, for example, the lowbrow humor as well as the wit in this book? I mean, there's a little bit of everything in here, going back to what you were saying about novels should... there's no problem with them entertaining. Is this just sort of... Did this come from Misha, or did this come from you in terms of wanting to entertain?
I think it just came from the way we talk and think now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess in some ways it's horrible to think about it, but in some ways Don Imus was a kind of Misha, you know, because he could entertain lofty subjects on his show, but then when the time came, he would. Well, Misha's very politically correct in his own way, but you know, he would dwell on the guttural in some ways.
Yeah.
So. And I never even heard of Imus until, you know, this whole thing happened. But now that I think about it, he could have been would have been fun to have gone on that show and dropped some fat beats, Misha style.
Well, he also sort of speaks to the kind of the level of political correctness that is currently in this country, in which, you know this kind of causes interesting things for you as a satirist, because, oh, wow, well, what do I say? Is the most minor kind of offensive thing going to offend?
Right, exactly.
Is this kind of an issue for you, or
this book, you know, has offended every stripe of reader imaginable? You know, Russians, Jews, Azeris, Armenians, Canadian nutria farmers. I mean, you name it. People are, you know, it makes people upset. When you write satire, you're going to step on people's toes. There's just no way around it. And if people aren't upset, then you're not doing your job.
Yeah.
You know, so it's. I don't want to hurt people's feelings, obviously, but there is this aspect of, in a way, you know, I'm not Misha, and people always conflate the two, which was very funny, you know, because when Russian Debutante's handbook came out, that character looked a lot more like me, sounded a lot more like me, and people really could not distinguish us.
Yeah.
But in some ways, having Misha as my foil this time around really... You know, as soon as I walk on a stage, everyone says, okay, it's not an autobiographical book.
Because he's not 325 pounds.
Not 325 pounds. So I think that was the distinction.
Actually, I mean, speaking of this kind of convergence between highbrow and lowbrow, I don't think I've ever seen a poetic symbol as the kissing of Misha's, you know, the underneath of his cui.
Oh, yeah.
How did this come about? Was there any literary precedent for this? Because I've never seen
not.
That, you know. This is quite an original poetic symbol here.
The kissing of the underside of the genital is something that just occurred to me, you know. And I hope it wasn't a fantasy, because the scene is written out in quite unsavory terms. But absolutely. In terms of poetic, I like it most when Misha starts to dream up Zagat restaurant surveys, you know. And I think there's a kind of prose poetry there, you know.
It's also, though, I guess, going back to these cultural contexts which we were discussing with technology, he's reciting these Zagat guides as if it's sort of a mantra or a catechism.
It is. It is. It's a catechism to him. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. You know, instead of Mao's red book, it's that little red book. That's, oddly enough, you know, that means more to him probably than anything else in the world other than his Rwanda, because it's a sign of safety, it's a sign of civilization, it's a sign of normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of times when I was in Russia, I didn't have the right documentation. I was worried, my God, they're not going to let me out. You know, it's a real fear. It's a bizarre fear because you can bribe your way out of anything. But sometimes I think, my God, what if I just have to live there for the rest of my life?
Well, we had mentioned Corbin McCarthy earlier, and I must mention how you were up against the road in the Tournament of Books.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, and it was pretty brutal because people went... Actually, though, the thing is it was sort of unfair because here you have a, you know, a great comic novel versus a great sort of apocalyptic novel. So, you know, comedy
it's also Cormac McCarthy at the height of his powers. I really don't think I can compete.
Yeah, but I guess the point is I wanted to raise this, is that every single judge sort of basically went with McCarthy, which sort of surprised me because I thought at least one of them would sort of, you know, acknowledge the more comic choice of the two, because comedy is often viewed as this unfortunate sort of lowbrow genre. People don't realize how much work it is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, do you feel that you have to work sometimes, I guess, three times as much as someone else?
Absolutely. No. The comic novel is always under suspicion. First of all, because publishers are very suspicious of it, because it's not something that you can always necessarily sell in terms of an audience. Humor is so subjective. You know, tragedy is tragedy. We all know how to respond to it. But humor is something incredibly subjective and requires a kind of sublimation of tragedy in order to achieve that. If it's just fun and jokes, then there's really no point to it.
Yeah.
So it's a very difficult, it is kind of walking a tightrope between two different kind of, especially, you know, this kind of Russian Jewish humor, which is just bathed in tragedy and unhappiness and anxiety and all these different things. So it becomes very difficult. But you have to look at the masters, you know, you look at Saul Bellow in Herzog, or you look at Philip Roth in Portnoy's Complaint. And you see how much is possible, how an entire portrait of a country, a society, a generation, and a male is possible just by using that kind of humor. And that's, you set that goal for yourself and you try to succeed.
Is an audience important to you? I mean, I kind of get the sense that it is, but I mean, we're also talking about, you know, well, at the same time, you have to have a voice, and that's, you know, if you're talking about the Venn diagram between universal appeal and absolutely, like, you know, the most safest humor possible versus the most, you know, uncompromising humor possible. Where does this hypothetical Venn diagram
fall
for you?
Well, I write exactly what I want to write, and I never change anything for the audience. You know, I never dumb it down. And that's what has always worried me. And I thought Absurdistan would not find an audience. You know, I was convinced of that. I was convinced that the book would do very poorly. I was surprised that I was paid a nice advance for it. I thought, my God, they're never going to see a penny of that. And I really thought, in a way, I underestimated the audience. I mean, these nice reviews have helped, and all these book clubs and stuff like that. But in some ways, I was very surprised that people would read a book with a hero this out there. You know, in terms of not just his weight, but everything, his ideas, the way he treats people, the way he treats his manservant. I really didn't think there would be a ready audience for this, and I'm still shocked to this day that I was able to connect with more readers than I was able to connect with my first book, which had a fairly lovable little runt of a guy.
And not just with readers, but also with the fact, you know, that it led to you being recognized by Grana. You know, I mean, is this something that concerns you?
It concerns me to the point that I want to make a living as a writer.
Sure.
That's important. But if I'm not able to, by doing the kind of stuff I do, then I'd be an urban planner, I don't know, something.
What I mean by concern, though, is that now all of a sudden, like, if you have people who are, like, sort of saying, oh, well, you know, Steingart, he's great. Then as you try to develop your voice, do you have a sort of set group of people who you can actually...
There are people that I really trust. One of them is Akhil Sharma, who is a very good friend of mine, a brilliant writer, one of the brilliant writers of my generation. And his sensibilities are very different from the sensibility of the average American. Good God, I mean... His last book, it was a brilliant book, was about, you know, this Indian civil servant who sleeps with his 9-year-old daughter. So, Oprah pick that will not be. But I really trust his judgment, and I think I have a really great editor at Random House, Dan Menaker, and who wrote a hilarious book himself called The Treatment a while back. So, you know, I'm very fortunate to have, like, a good team of people around me who are able to really give good advice and who understand my humor and who give advice not based on what the audience wants, but what... in a way that can maximize what I'm doing. That's very important. Very important. That's one of the things you get out of, like, say, an MFA program.
So ambition, then, just upping your game of each particular novel is a major factor for you to develop.
Oh, I thought that I was sort of losing steam with the second book. You know, the first book took 6 years to write. It was this 450-page book. This is a much slimmer volume. I really wasn't thinking of it in terms of ambition. I thought this book would do so badly. I was living in Italy at the time,
yeah.
And I was almost thinking, God, do I even dare return to the States with this crap, you know? So, I have a very pessimistic view of everything, you know?
You seem very cheery about it.
Yeah. And one thing I'm certainly pessimistic is about just, it's nice that I have this readership, but what will happen to future generations? Will there be readers in future generations, you know? How will literature fare down the line with all these electronic blandishments and a culture that's really has trouble, I think, connecting with other people, with empathizing with other people. It's a culture very self-centered. You know, the video game is the perfect example. People want to be the avatar. They want to be the hero on the screen. Another example is there's this huge growth of MFA programs, and a lot of them are wonderful, and I teach at one sometimes. But there's this incredible growth in people who want to write, who want to tell their story. But it's counterbalanced by a decline in the readership. So it's the ultimate in ironies. You know?
I don't know, though. I mean, you know, if by electronic brandishments, are you referring to things like lit blogs? Or what are you referring to?
Oh, no. I'm just referring to people whose main, you know, for example, for the book I'm writing now, I have to research a lot of the way people communicate on the internet, the younger generations especially.
Things like Twitter and MySpace.
MySpace is a perfect example. You know, you have all these sites and these kids are not, they do not think of the written word as a part of their life, other than, I mean, in terms of literature, in terms of even nonfiction, it doesn't matter. I'm not talking kids 12, 13 years old, I'm talking about teenagers, people in college, you know, it's just not a part of their life. That's not how they view the world. The world is viewed entirely through connectivity and through through the image and the sound, but there's a lack of... opening up a book, which basically means inhabiting another person's mind. You know, everybody wants to throw themselves out there. Everybody wants to show their face and their here. This is what I like. These are my stuff. This is this is what I'm about. This is where I shop. That's a great category. Always where I shop. But there's a lack of interest in what it actually takes to inhabit another person's mind, which is what a book does.
But I guess it could also be counter-argued that sometimes these are sort of, I guess, launching pads for getting people to, you know, it's sort of a kind of, I guess, a crutch for people to kind of eventually find, perhaps.
Well, we don't know that yet. Yeah. We don't. I mean, that
it's still in its infancy.
I hope that's the case. I hope that. But it's so much in its infancy that I certainly hope that's the case. I mean, yeah, these things could be cyclical, you know. But right now, it's clear that the image is ascendant right now and that the word is in many ways fighting for its life. I mean, America does have several hundred thousand very good readers, and you know that's a very sizable amount of people. And if I can connect with half of them, I'm very happy about that.
So you really just you believe fiction is on its way out, or?
I think fiction is in trouble right now. I don't think it's on its way. People will always be writing novels. There's no question about that. It's a wonderful form. It's one of the most honest forms possible. Even though it's fiction, I think it's a lot more honest than some of these ridiculous memoirs that you encounter along the way. But its readership is very much in doubt right now. We will have to see.
Because of the internet? Because of the MySpace? Or because of sales? I'm just trying to understand
this. Well, it's a chicken and egg thing. I mean, sales would be coming from all these other factors. Sales is just the final tally you get. It's a good question. I think we are slowly losing intellectual rigor as a society. I think we are becoming very Misha-like. You know, Misha may spout... literary quotes, but what he's really interested in is consuming. You know, what he's really interested in is what's in his stomach, what's on his large body, who he's inside. You know, that's the kind of stuff that appeals to him. And those are very basic needs. Those are very basic needs that aren't particular to any one place, space, or time. But that's what interests me is what will happen to our society, whether there will be this kind of literary mediation or whether we will move entirely into just a consumerist society.
But if you are convinced that, you know, for you personally, this intellectual rigor of the mind is absolutely necessary, and you're also convinced that this audience is, you know, exists, this minor audience, in which intellectual rigor is just simply not a part of the program, then how can you continue to operate? Or is it just, you had mentioned in another interview I read where you could not exist without writing or something.
Absolutely. No, I would write no matter, if I had zero audience. When I was writing Russian Dipendence Handbook, I didn't think it would ever be published.
Yeah.
You know, I was writing it just for myself and maybe I'd show some friends, you know, and then it almost happened by accident. I'd applied to a program with Chang Rui Lee and he said, we can publish this right now. I just sent him some, I thought I would write something else, and I just submitted these pages as a kind of, you know, teaser.
Yeah.
I will always write, of course, you know. Poets today, their audience is diminished to, you know, the five digits, not the four figures. You know, it's a very, very small audience for serious poetry. And they continue to do it, and programs to teach poetry flourish. More and more people apply to these programs. It will always be there.
Yeah.
It's just a question of what role will it play in our culture.
Well, there are these slam poetry sessions that seem to attract a lot of audiences.
That's very
good. They're not, you know, you're not going to get Walt Whitman up there, no, or anything.
Well, maybe Walt Whitman would have gone up on, yeah, on those things. I could sort of see it.
Well, I could see that, you know, if he existed.
My ass. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Oh, actually, I wanted to talk about Misha's butchered circumcision. Again, this really, you know, classy sort of approach to the scatological. Is this what it takes to get dick jokes by? Or?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, dick jokes have been mined pretty much, pretty hard, so to speak. No, it's about religion, I think, and it's about,
yeah,
it's about a family relationship more than anything. It's about a father getting his son circumcised. I'm always thinking of that Abraham and Isaac painting, you know, the,
yeah,
sacrifice of Isaac. So it's more about their relationship than it is about actually any yeah, foreskins being chopped off. But yeah, I've wanted, a lot of Russians of my generation went through this as young adults, you know, and I can tell you it hurts, you know, on rainy days especially. So it's just another facet of the Russian Jewish, of the Soviet Jewish experience that I wanted to cover, that maybe I thought maybe would not be covered.
Did you feel that, I guess, going to the kind of multiple locations that this book takes place in, did you feel that certain aspects, did you try to kind of at least flesh out certain aspects of Misha's character in certain sorts of areas? I got the sense, for example, in New York, he seemed to kind of, you know, we talked about the Zagat obsession, but I mean, were there conscious aspects on you to sort of bring out certain sides of Misha that were allowed to flourish in relation to certain environments?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, the book has three main settings: New York, St. Petersburg, Russia, and a fictional country. And
yeah,
I wanted Misha. I mean, Misha hates one place, is intrigued by the second place, and wants to go back to the third place. So
yeah,
it's definitely all about his yearning. But I do want to, you know, I write a lot of travel articles. I work for Travel and Leisure a lot. One of my favorite things to do is just to write travelogues. It's one of my favorite essay forms. So in some ways, I was almost doing a kind of a riff off of these different places. I wanted to capture them at a certain, seen through his eyes, because it's a first-person narrative, but also just capture all these different places, because they are changing so rapidly. You know, New York is changing rapidly. St. Petersburg is just completely changing. And even the oil-rich countries in the south, to the south of Russia, are changing as well. So I wanted to really make sure that that was there for the reader.
Yeah. Is omniscient voice something that just really doesn't allow these kind of specific observations to come across like this?
Or? I like first person. I like I like being tethered to one person. I also love, as you can tell, I love emails and stuff like that. I love letters. The epistolary form has always been a big part of what I do. And this book is going to be very heavy, the one I'm working on now. Very much involved in that. So I'll always, look, I got a lot of books in me, and I'm going to play around with all kinds of different stuff until I find something.
A lot of letters and emails, too.
Yeah, yeah, I love getting emails. I love writing emails.
It's an addictive conduit.
It's addictive, but sometimes
so the internet is not all bad here.
Yeah, it can be quite fun, actually.
Yeah.
It can be quite fun.
It's the ultimate distraction. Sometimes.
It is so distracting, and I want to buy a place upstate or rent a place upstate where, for some reason, there is no wireless. I don't know if such a place exists. I want to, just so I can get my work done, you know, because it's very distracting.
Log cabin or something.
Log cabin with, but with food, with, what do you call it, where I can order out food because I don't know how to cook, so.
Really?
I'm a Luddite in the kitchen.
How have you managed to last this long?
I live in Manhattan. Everyone brings me food, you know.
Well, Gary, thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Modern architecture already left a decay.